The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Lori Moore's acclaimed fiction includes the short story collections Self-Help, Bark, and Birds of America, and the novels Anagrams, Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, and A Gate at the Stairs. The Gertrude Conaway Professor of English at Vanderbilt University, she is the recipient of the Irish Times Prize for Literature, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Penn Malamud Award, among many other honors. She was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2001 and to the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 2005. A reviewer for the New York Times says she may be exactly the most irresistible contemporary American writer. Brainy, humane, unpretentious and warm, seemingly effortlessly lyrical, Lily Tomlin funny. From fiction reviews to deep dives into prestige TV to the state of the Republican Party, her new collection, See What Can Be Done, gives us a brilliant mind's view of the artistic, cultural, and political moments that have defined our country for the past 30 years. She'll be joined in conversation this evening by Jane Ann Phillips, award-winning writer of the contemporary classics Black Tickets and Machine Dreams, and director of Rutgers University Newark's MFA Creative Writing Program. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lori Moore and Jane Ann Phillips to the Free Library.
Thank you all for coming. And we thought what we would do is I would read a little bit from this book, and then we would chat, and then we'll open it up for questions from you. And you can move forward if you want, or you can stay where you are. This book of mine is mostly, whoops, that's my hotel key. is mostly critical essays, but I do have one or two personal essays. I really don't write personal essays very much, but I wrote one about 8 years ago, I can't remember what year it was, for a magazine that I'd never heard of. They wanted something, and so I wrote for them, and then they killed the piece. So, you know, I always think Kilfy would be a great name for a murder mystery. And then the magazine itself went under, so there was, and then my agent decided that this piece was so depressing she didn't want to place it anywhere else. But I was looking it over when I was putting this book together, and I thought, I still think it's sort of funny. And of course, it's factual, it's true. It's about my getting married, which did happen. So I'm going to read a little bit of it. I'm going to start a ways in. I'll just start at the beginning. A bride on her summer honeymoon, what could be more beguiling? Well, a younger bride to begin with, one less destined to wear an off-white suit at the ceremony. And what's with that anyway? The advertising of a lady's past, the beige and ivory taint of autobiography dyed like a scarlet A into the very threads of her dress. Why not say it another way and wear yellow, black, or green? Why not horizontal stripes? Chinese brides wear red as did Jane Austen's mother, who later cut up her attire for outfits for the kids, who wouldn't want something actually bright and cuttable? I'd always had a little trouble with anything called an institution. I was 34 and had been seeing the same man for 4 consecutive years and living with him for 2. Not a record for anyone except for him. We spent the spring fretting. Should we get married? He felt we should in this moving through life way. It was what came next, which would, in turn, of course, quickly introduce the idea of divorce. We are all fiends for narrative, plot, rising action. I wondered whether our marrying should really be this notch in the belt of time. Shouldn't it be rather an emotional and spiritual referendum on us? If we needed an event, we could, say, break up. Get married or break up, that's pretty much what it came down to. Love went without saying, so we didn't say it. Perhaps we were a little bored. Something we both seemed to agree should probably occur. Though looking back, I'm not sure why. It was just motion, momentum. But with the tulips up, the air warming, and then suddenly the tulips down, petalless, bug-like, and leaning, still we remained undecided. We both understood I would not change my name to his, but privately, I felt this might not augur well for the success of our union. I suspected, quite correctly, I think now, that those women who changed their names to match their husbands understood something about marriage that I was in the dark about. My boyfriend was of the school of thought that marriage, like a house or a car, was a necessary accoutrement of adulthood. I was resistant to that school of thought and wasn't really in any school of thought at all, not a certified one, not in a matriculated way. To quote Daniel Handler's adverbs, I was letting my thoughts run around the yard rather than reporting inside. Or to quote from Richard Yates's The Best of Everything, a familiar little panic gripped her. She couldn't marry him. She hardly even knew him. Sometimes it occurred to her differently that she couldn't marry him because she knew him too well. And either way, it left her badly shaken. Summer was approaching, so all right, we would at least begin the process. Otherwise, I hardly needed reminding. I was risking the possibility of a life wherein the in case of emergency contact space, I would repeatedly be writing me. One noon hour after lunch in a nearby fish place, we strolled over to the county courthouse. There we filled out the application for a marriage license. This license was simply a permission slip, like a hunting license. It gave us 45 days to do the deed. In that time period, one could deer hunt, D-E-A-R, using the language of the state, although also in the language of this state, what most hunters looked for, frankly, was a nice rack, which may have accounted for my new fiancé's sudden clutching of his stomach. The clerk behind her desk raised her eyebrows. I'm feeling some horrible pain, said the masculine owner of this new license, looking faintly green. Seen it before, said the clerk, but not usually this fast. The great thing about this piece is I didn't invent the dialogue. You don't have to invent dialogue. It's just kind of out there in the world. This was all his idea, I said, or mostly. I think it was the fish, moaned you-know-who, whose name, we'll say, was Mike. I ate the same fish, I said. I feel fine. You see, said the clerk. Mike was bent over in his chair, clutching his stomach, but he did not excuse himself to go anywhere else. And so this is what makes marriage possible. No one actually getting up and running away. Although a few unmarried weeks followed, in which some discussion ensued, I don't really recall any of it. The next thing I do recall is getting up and dressing in an I'll-be-damned cream-colored suit. We were on our way to the county courthouse to get married that morning with one friend and one clerk as witnesses, and then we would be getting on a plane, flying to Seattle and renting a car so we could drive down the small Pacific Coast Highway to Los Angeles. This would be our honeymoon. Outside in the judge's office, where we were to be married, a camera crew had assembled, all sitting wearily on the corridor floor with their equipment. They were from 60 Minutes and were apparently waiting for us. "I didn't know your short stories were that well known," exclaimed Mike, looking proud and amazed. "Yes, well," I said, not wanting to disappoint him so soon. "What could these people want?" "We were here earlier in the week to do a story on the governor's Wedfare program." It was something the governor of Wisconsin did briefly, and it, if you got married, you got more welfare payments. It was really stupid. But we left without getting footage of an actual welfare couple getting married. We just need some footage, so we had to fly back last night, and we heard a marriage was scheduled for this morning. "Us?" I asked, "but we're not on welfare." "That part doesn't matter. No one will know that. We just have to film two people getting married in this building." This particular parsing of reality troubled me. If they were going to pretend any couple was a welfare couple, marrying to increase state benefits to themselves, as per the governor's murky thinking on the matter, thinking that briefly went national, why not also save on airfare and pretend any building was this building? It was a generic municipal building. For 10 seconds of footage, they didn't need this one. If something was already half a lie, then it was really a whole lie. So make it a whole one. The crew looked bleary, as if having just concluded a blistering gig with National Geographic. My new, soon-to-be husband's face brightened. "We'd get to be on TV," he said to me, clearly game for this. That he was capable of being game for most anything, I realized, was the reason we were getting married and the reason we would be divorced 10 years later. But it could not be a reason for our being on 60 Minutes as an ersatz welfare couple. "God, no," I said. The crew looked devastated. The judge's clerk shrugged, and my husband-to-be then tried this angle. "It would be funny." "It could be," said the head of the camera crew, hopefully. Although Mike would have donned a big rubber suit to play a betrothing walrus on Wild Kingdom because it would be funny, I could not participate. "It would be bad luck," I said. "No." "Really?" "Really." "She says no," said Mike. "She says no," said the clerk to the camera crew, who sat there grumbling and tired. "The bride says no," said the judge himself, standing in the doorway. And that is how my marriage began.
So, Lori, to quote your book, writers that you quote in your book, "Writing is very much like a kiss. It's something you can't do alone," said John Cheever. "I disagree." And Auden said, "The writer marries the language and writing is born." So I'm switching from marriage to writing, in case you didn't catch that.
Oh, I see. You're doing.
However, I want to quote you, page 60. "One has to give in to one's work like a lover, not necessarily a husband. Give and give and try not to pick fights," which I thought is a great quote.
Yeah, I wrote that when I was young.
So reading you on writing was so wonderful. I love the way the book has reviews and criticism and essays, but I was loving little things about writing that sort of appeared everywhere. And some of the things that I loved most, you talked about writing as the lost, as being having to do with the lost perspective that goes with being immersed. That writing is workmanlike, tenacious, skilled labor, but also mysterious. That artists are God's dream. Literary fiction, it's God's compulsion handed down to us, an echo, a diminishment, but something we're made to do in imitation or perhaps in honor of the original creation. Writing is there to keep us interested in ourselves so that we can attach to this life, which might otherwise be unbearable. And that is why Laurie has such a reputation as a humorist. Right? She also said, well, quoting someone else, you said, it has been said that erotic love, like certain religions, seems to contain the meaning of life without actually disclosing it. And Laurie is saying that death itself, it just seems like a mistake. That death is a major design flaw. And you know how sometimes when you read something, you read it wrong? When I read that, I read, death is a major design flaw.
That too.
Which is so much more optimistic. So I want to talk a little bit about writing in terms of life and death, right?
I have no idea what your question is, Jenny.
Oh, it's not a question.
Okay.
Death as a major design flaw.
Flaw.
Flaw. Flaw.
Flaw. Yeah.
Well, what is that space about? What is that space in writing that sort of breaks through simultaneity of time, the sort of past, present, and future are no longer really seen in their perfect spaces, and it's become something else?
What?
Does that ever happen to you?
You know, on the train here from D.C., I was reading this article in the New Yorker. Did you read this?
About the black ice?
About the young woman who disappeared in St. Thomas because she has this dissociative...
No, I didn't.
Mental glitch where she... It gets triggered and she forgets who she is. But I thought, that's a little bit what happens when you're at your desk writing and things are going well, except you don't disappear and leave your car and pocketbook in the parking lot. But you're at your desk and you disappear into this other world and you are, there's something that prompts the writing. There's some emotions and ideas you want to explore and register and contain within the characters and within the language and voice that you're using. But it is a kind, are you, yeah, so it is a kind of extension of one's life. It's an enlargement. And presumably that's why we read as well, that we want to enlarge our own lives by disappearing into a narrative. But this young woman in St. Thomas was never found.
She's off living another life.
She's writing. She might be writing in a cave somewhere. It was a wild piece because it was... Apparently this is a very rare disorder, but that they do believe is just an exaggeration of something more ordinary that happens. And so I did think, well, that's, the more ordinary thing that happens is when you sort of slightly leave your constructed self when you write.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that there are... Is it four essay or four reviews of Monroe in the book?
Actually, I've done about six. I only included three. I thought I was those showing were, great
those, I love those. Those are wonderful. I mean, of course, I'm a Monroe fan also, but they're so different and they're so interesting. And I love one of the things you said having to do with Monroe were this whole idea of, well, what's autobiographical? And people looking around for what's real about Monroe's life. And Laurie said, we imagine persons other than ourselves in fiction, but the journey to those persons is paradoxically and necessarily through one's own life. The forces of imagination and concentration, the kind of autobiographical energy, no matter what one is writing about. And that wonderful story, Family Furnishings, that's sort of about theft. I mean, your take on it is sort of, and Monroe's really writing about writing, the dark side of writing.
Yeah.
What some people see as the dark side of writing, like the idea, but her, she sets up the perfect test case because she writes, the writer in the story is writing about her cousin who had a very dark beginning to life when her mother was burned, very badly burned, when a lamp exploded and the child lost her mother.
Right.
And there's this line, the child is 6 or 7 years old, and they're in the hospital, and someone comes to her and says, your mother is very, very ill, and you can't go in. And the child says, but she would want to see me.
Right. They say, you can't see her. And she says, but she would want to see me.
And then later, when she's recounting this, she makes out as though she was being proud, or like, I'm so important that she would want to see me. So she misremembers her own story, and that's what the story is about.
But the character who is the writer who's hearing her cousin, Elfrieda, tell this story, recognizes it for what it is, and that's what it is to be a writer in the family. You recognize certain things that the rest of your family doesn't. You recognize the true meaning of them, and you lift them out of context and put them in a context that illuminates the meaning of them. But of course, no one wants to have a writer in the family doing that kind of thing. And so it is a story about having a writer in the family, and how for the writer there's a certain amount of freedom and escape, and there's this kind of joyous release at the end where she gets to go have coffee and sit at a diner all by herself. But it in fact is full of shame and guilt as well, because she also knows that that's what art is, that it is a kind of theft, and it is a kind of betrayal of one's family and one's intimacies. But that's why we call it fiction. That's the safety of fiction.
Well, see, I want to also propose that not always a theft. I mean, a theft in this story, because when you say she illuminates, it's about an exploding lamp, so it's almost a kind of double entendre.
It also has that, I don't know if you remember the story, it has this incest event in it, which I just ignore because it's just too much for the story. But when I teach it, my students are all like, but what about the incest? And I just, oh God, I can't go there. Do you remember that in there?
Yeah.
So it's about discovering family secrets. She discovers that her father and her cousin, or her father and her father's cousin, have actually fallen in love and had a baby long, long ago. And this baby is her own age and grows up and comes to the funeral they're at the end. But it's so much to put in one story that I just pretend it's not there.
And she sort of leaps beyond all that. The end lines of the story, the cries of the crowd came to me like big heartbeats full of sorrows, lovely formal sounding waves with their distant, almost inhuman assent and lamentation, like straight out of Revelation. This story is not a good example because the writer in the story could have changed the details a little bit, like instead of an exploding lamp, something else.
Well, she kind of forgets, and then she goes back, and when she gets accused of having taken this stuff from her family, she says, "No, I changed it. I wasn't using that at all." But she says, "But then I went back and looked at what I'd written, and there it all was, you know." But because once you put it in and get into your dissociated head, you're no longer a member of your family. You're creating this story.
And without that dissociative head, you would never write a word.
I know, you need it.
And no one would have a word to read. I always tell my students not to think about anyone when they're writing, certainly not their families.
No.
Not to think about any reader.
No.
And that there's an element of saving things from vanishing by writing about something that did happen, or transforming something that never happened into fiction. Because after all, the cousin is going to be gone, the person that heard the story is going to be gone. Alice Munro is not gone.
No, she'll never.
But we'll always have, you know, those stories. What was it that she herself said?
I'm not sure. In Family Furnishings?
No, it's in here somewhere, but let's go forward with... There probably are questions that the audience want to know, things like, how, why did you start writing?
Oh, how or why?
How and why.
Not where.
Where too?
Where? I don't know. I was always drawing and writing and doing... Well, you know this, you know, because we were girls growing up in the 50s and 60s. And girls growing up in the 50s and 60s were encouraged to be artistic, right? Mm. I felt that. Not artists.
Motherly. I was encouraged to be motherly.
You were?
Mm-hmm.
I was encouraged. We were, I mean, we would get together... I mean, as 8-year-olds, see, now all of this kind of play is organized by adults and organizations, but we would get together and we would put on plays, we would play instruments, we would sing songs. We weren't even 10 years old yet. And then that continued into high school, and we would, you know, we would play guitars and write songs and sing harmony, and, you know, so all of that was going on. And, you know, if you're a moody teenager and you're writing poems and songs and, you know, soon you're writing stories. So that's what happened. And I also got encouraged by teachers.
Was there any particular writer whose work really kind of set you off when you were young?
I don't know that I can say that. I read a lot of, you know, I babysat a lot in high school, so I read a lot of junk that the parents of the children I was babysitting for had in their house. So I read, like, The Exorcist, and I read Such Good Friends, and do you remember that Lois Gould novel,
mm-hmm.
Such Good Friends? Her editor is now my editor, so it's destiny.
It's amazing you didn't end up writing for the movies.
Yeah. How amazing that I didn't do that.
You still could. Here's the quote.
Okay.
In fiction, real turmoil is made artificial turmoil only to become real turmoil again.
That's very well put.
Well, right. I loved what you said about trying to write about books or trying to write essays. Never relatable instead of sympathetic. Or impact as a verb, or any form of the word enjoy, which should be reserved for one's grandparents or other relatives.
Well, that's a little snarky and snide of me, but I really don't like that word relatable. But everybody uses it. I'm just too old for it, I think. You don't use it, do you?
Relatable? No.
No.
Or impact as a verb. It impacted me.
No.
It impacted me furiously.
No. Impacted me relatably. I don't enjoy that. That was in the introduction where I just was saying here are some words you won't find. But probably everyone has their own pet peeves and words that they don't like that I do use. So.
And what did you? I love this, but I'm not sure what it means. The first person pronoun can be a form of deference.
Well, a form of, did I say deference or modesty? Did I say deference?
Mm-hmm.
I did.
I think so.
Well, it's not always, you know, we're taught in school when we're little that you're not supposed to, you know, be in the first person when you're writing your book reports. And that you're not to intrude upon the essay with the first person pronoun. But there are ways, because it would be too arrogant and too self-regarding and too, you know, self-focused. But in fact, there's a way in which inserting oneself just briefly can be an act of modesty vis-a-vis the thing you're discussing. And then I go on to say, when I said that, I think, that there's a kind of God-like quality in not using the first-person pronoun, even though God supposedly used the first-person pronoun himself, but that you don't have to speak in the authoritative voice of omniscience all the time and decide that that's the modest way of talking about something. You can say, I read this book while I was sitting by a swimming pool. And I was riveted, or whatever. I mean, that, there's a modesty in saying that. It doesn't upset the...
It puts you on par with your reader.
Yes, and it situates the book in the real world and in the reader's life.
And you do that in the reviews in a really, really sophisticated, natural way. You also say... If you try to write in the authoritative third-person voice of God and fail, you may end up sounding like flap copy, which I think is good advice to any writer. In the review about Heartburn, you said, catharsis is nowhere to be glimpsed, which is how art should be.
Yeah, I'm kind of against catharsis, but I mean, but there might be times when catharsis is okay.
But it's so personal. What's catharsis for one is not catharsis for another.
And
right?
I also don't think a writer should say, I wrote this because I had to. I had to sort of vent. I had to, you know, have my catharsis. I just feel like, well, that's not very nice for the reader, you know, that you're just handing over your catharsis. You're supposed to be constructing a work of art. Now, it may have cathartic aspects for the author, and it may have cathartic aspects also for the readers. But it shouldn't be at the center of the project, I think.
It should be very personal, one reader to another.
Yeah.
Well, you also said about Bobby Ann Mason, this wonderful piece that comes a bit from the past. It was so great to read that again or see it again, since she has a new book coming out.
She does?
When
is that coming out?
Pretty soon.
It's a novel?
No, it's a collection of essays and stories, and it's called Patchwork.
Ah.
But you have this wonderful piece where you say that Mason collects what she knows like a curator or spy rather than what she thinks, which was such an interesting way to look at the work. The profundity and depth in her collections, which layer overlap, echo dimension and depth, the knowledge of her material, endless and huge, naked voice without vanity. Great essay.
Well, I felt with Bobby and Mason that she, again, sort of like Monroe, although she's not as great a writer, obviously, as Monroe, but that she's collecting from the stuff around her, from family life, from community life, and she's doing so, like Monroe, without judgment. You know, she's not doing it with a strong opinion, but more like with a photographer's eye.
And just letting the reader react.
Yeah, like here it is. Mm-hmm. This is the way these people I know live now.
I mean, when you talk about the piece in The New Yorker, about the girl who disappeared, you mention... reading cultural criticism can be like an afterlife of the original encounter.
Yeah, lots of times, and I know everyone in this room has felt that, where you read something or you watch something or you listen to something, you've had this experience, and then you want to go and have a conversation about it, or you want to read what someone else thought about it. We were just doing that backstage with the play Irma. We kind of disagree on it, but whatever. You really want to... and so you want to relive it, through reading about it. And you can do that by... That's why it's so much better to read reviews after you've seen something, as you all know. Or you can read it before and after, but those are completely different experiences, reading a review after you've read or seen something. And it's a more useful thing, I think, too, to read it after. When you read it beforehand, you really don't know what's being discussed at all. But when you read it afterward, you're reliving, revisiting the original experience you had. Or having a slightly different version of it, or a conversation with your original experience. I could ask you questions, Jane Ann.
Oh, no.
I want to hear.
No, I have something right here.
I have a question, though. I want to know.
One thing, though. Okay. You talk about the main struggle for every writer is the dance and limitation of language, to honor the texture of it, but also make it unafraid, to listen sentence to sentence, hearing what comes next.
Yeah, everything you write has a sound. You know this. Every book you have has a sound, and if it fails to have a sound, it just will fail. But getting the sound of the book is getting it started successfully, and you start to hear what the book is going to sound like, and that's the most important thing.
And that for the writer, it's like listening to a whisper. It's like you can't quite make out the words, but
and
you
you're
hear
right,
something.
You're writing the sound, and you can you decide whether that is the right sound, and you can revise it until you get it, and then you suddenly have the sound. And once you have the sound of the book, and you just are running with it, it's very, very exciting. Struggling to get the sound of it is the hardest part, I think.
A friend of mine says, when people ask her religion, she says, film. But I think writing is a bit like a religious activity or a meditative practice. It's a practice in which you sit there not trying to forget words, but trying to pull words out of the air, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess. Are you pulling them out of the air?
You're pulling them out of...
You're inventing a voice, and it's the voice of the book, and this book that's not yet written and your imagination are trying to find each other and connect. And soon they do. And then what you're doing is entering scenes with characters, and you're trying to see what these people are doing in the room, and what they're wearing, and what they're saying to each other.
It's like when you get that prompt, the printer is trying to find the computer, or the printer, or the computer is trying to find the printer.
Right.
It's that esoteric and sort of magical.
I know. It's artificial intelligence.
It's real intelligence. So I don't know if people have questions in the audience. If you don't, I have more questions for Lori. But
we can ask you about what it was to be in West Virginia growing up and being encouraged to be maternal. Because I was not encouraged to... Well, I mean, we had dolls. Are you talking about just dolls and playing house?
I had so many dolls.
I had dolls, too.
So many dolls. I remember my mother taking those little Kodak pictures of me, because I was getting older. I was getting to be about 11. Lined up all the dolls on her big, high bed, and there I stand in my jumper beside all of my dolls.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
No, it wasn't really.
My mother, one of my most, I don't know, my mother is kind of a complicated person, but one of the most beautiful memories I have of her is she would sew a lot. And it was either my birthday or Christmas, or I think it was actually in spring, so it might have been Easter. She had secretly sewn all new outfits for my dolls. And she had dressed them all in the night while I was sleeping and arranged them all around the room. They had little hats and little booties and gloves and capes. And I woke up in my bed to see this magical thing. Isn't that?
And our mothers were sisters. One Christmas, my mother had my father carry me out of my bedroom. She had made a whole new bedroom suite, that is, curtains, duster, coverlet, shams, little table and chairs, a bride doll sitting in the chair, a new bed that was like a very high bed. And when I woke up, it was in this new room.
Right.
This is, must have been what happened to us.
Maybe they all read the same magazine article that's like from Women's Day that said, do this for your little girls. They'll love it.
I did love it.
I did too.
Yeah, I did too.
But that's what sewing machines were for. Ours was in the dining room, the sewing machine. But, oh wow. Yes.
I'm just curious. I know you're both, is this right?
Yeah.
I know you both teach college students, and I'm just wondering what they're interested in writing these days. Maybe what they're interested in reading. I don't know if you'd know that, but I'm wondering if the writing interests have changed as you're enduring your careers.
You want me to go first?
Mm-hmm.
All right. One thing, and I know you'll agree, I mean, that's, well, but maybe I'm more focused on this because it's a puzzle to me. All these students who are under 30, they're the Harry Potter generation. They all have read all the Harry Potter books. And we did not have a set of books that we all read as a child. There was some overlap. There was Alice in Wonderland, and there was, C.S. Lewis. Actually, I didn't read C.S. Lewis till later. But it is unprecedented, the Harry Potter thing. And it invades, it infects their imagination. They use the characters as shorthand, you know, in similes and metaphors, like, and they all know what each other is talking about. And they also believe, and so it informs their kind of their sense of the universe. They all believe that they have a hidden power, and that they just need to find it. And so they write characters that are like that. And it's really the Harry Potter invasion. They are, you know, I've always had very, very smart students, you know, but the first day of class, I sometimes like to do a desert island thing, like just to get to know them. What would you take to a desert island? And they always have really interesting music. And so I do music, film, and books. And then they have some interesting movies, although sometimes the movies are Harry Potter movies. And then the books are always Harry Potter. And then they argue over which Harry Potter book is the best book to bring to the desert island. And so their sophistication in music is at odds with this children's literature. They don't really understand it's children's literature. They sort of do, but they feel they've read some of the Harry Potter books they've read 10 times.
Oh.
You know, it's something they go back into like a bubble bath, like they just know it and love it, and it's consoling. And that is new. That is new. And for people teaching creative writing, and I've been doing it for 30 odd years.
Did you find this at Wisconsin as well as Vancouver?
Yeah, yeah. It started when Harry Potter started. I found it at Princeton.
I don't find that in my students at all.
No Harry Potter?
Uh-uh. I mean, they probably read it, but it doesn't come up in conversation or as a touchstone. I mean, I think the students in Newark, 57% of them are students of color in the grad program, though they come from 12 states, two countries.
It might be a white, upper middle class thing. It might be.
It might be a little bit of that, because
it might be that
we do have students that graduate from Duke and Yale and Harvard and, you know, a lot of these very good schools. But maybe the very fact that they're coming to Newark means they're not so enamored of Harry Potter.
What's different about
I think what's different is that unless someone is a real student of pop culture, they know so little about what happened in the past. And writers who are even still alive, who've written important work, you can say their name and it's like blank. They're always ready to find out about somebody else, you know, new things that they haven't heard about.
But have you asked them about Harry Potter?
I think if I did, they'd throw their cups at me.
I think you should try.
I will sneak it into conversation,
yeah, so
but
yeah,
I
we'll see.
Get the sense that
it's a not their touchstone. It's a middle class thing, but I'll bet they've read it.
I don't think my kids even, I know they read the first one.
See, there you go.
But I don't remember their following it and
see,
reading all
See, but you
of
have
them.
Boys, see, and the boys.
You think it's mostly girls?
Well, girls used to be, always be the readers, but even the boys have read Harry Potter now.
I'm going to find out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that's the necessarily the case with my students, but I'll find out. This lady here has a question.
Hi, so I'm wondering, do you prefer to write short stories or novels? That's part one of the question. Part two is, when you have an idea for a character or a story, do you know whether it's a short story or a novel? Or how do you know?
Yeah, I do know, and I don't know how it is that I know. I just feel that this character is really... I only have 20 pages for this character. Like, this character belongs in something small, as opposed to a novel where I feel I have to do something over a long stretch of time. A novel covers a period of time, and you have, so when you're with a character through a novel, it's a commitment. And so I do feel that at the beginning. Not every writer is like that, though. I mean, Alice Munro, we're back to her, but she often has begun stories as novels. She's sort of famous for that. And that's why her novels are so, her short stories are so dense and complicated, because they were conceived as novels. And they have, you know, they're like ships built in bottles. They have all the complications, and they even have the travel through time that novels have. And so they're absolutely unusual that way. But for me, it's just a much more ordinary thing. I can just feel that this character, you know, there's usually a situation or an idea that I want to put a character in, and so suddenly the situation and the character are having a kind of dialogue, and that's, I can feel right away that that's a story, and a novel is something else. And do I prefer one to the other? I prefer whatever it is I'm working on, and I'm working on a novel right now. So, yeah.
I'm curious about the stories you each told about your mothers and sewing.
Yeah.
Do you think that they were fulfilling their own dreams, which just happened to be applied to you?
Oh, you mean living vicariously? Like they wanted...
It's what they would have wanted as children and never had, but they could do for you.
I do feel that a little bit. And I was... You were the only girl in your family, right?
Yes.
And I was the only girl for a while. And then my sister came along when I was older. But I was a girl between two boys, and so I think my mother really wanted to give me some girly things that she didn't perhaps have. But she was doing a lot of sort of domestic... our mothers were of a generation where they had lots of domestic skills. I mean, I can do nothing. I mean, I can't sew, I can't bake bread, I can't do anything. But my mother could do all that. But eventually she stopped. I think she started to feel the enslavement of that and the diminishing returns of that, of But she's still alive. I should ask her.
It sort of it subjugates creativity.
Yeah. But to arrange all those dolls and their costumes is a piece of theater.
My mother definitely wasn't living through me or... I mean, in the first place, I have no small motor coordination. The first time my mother sewed anything, she sewed a suit. You know, she just was incredibly talented at sewing, embroidering, cross-stitching, quilts,
yeah,
everything. She was actually very embarrassed by my being a writer.
Very embarrassed?
Well, here, you know, my first book comes out, a little small press book with her wedding picture on the cover, years after she and my father had divorced. She used to keep the book in the piano bench.
And it's called Sweetheart.
But she was amazingly encouraging. She used to say, I bought all of you books, and you're the only one who read them. The boys just threw them down.
You talked about the modesty of the first person, but I remember in 2012 I fell in love with you, your voice for the second person, and you caught some grief, even Scott's caught some grief for it. People parried
self-help.
And you did, you know, yeah. It just entranced me because, I mean, it's very possible to do it badly, but you did it so beautifully. So, I mean, what was it? Was that you talking to yourself? It's like, you do this, you do that.
I wrote those stories when I was in graduate school, so I was in my mid-20s, and I had noticed... I wanted to tell not very interesting stories in an interesting way, and I had noticed that poets used the second person all the time.
Yes.
Some of my favorite poems were in the second person, and I thought, what if you did this kind of mock imperative, you know, that made fun of this sort of self-help culture by doing a mock imperative voice that tells you how not to do something.
And you never felt necessary to go back again to the second person?
No, I felt quite... In fact, I only intended to write one story in that point of view. And that story, it's in my first collection called Self-Help, and it's called How. I didn't say how anything else. I just thought, how? And I just wanted to write one story like that. But it cut such a groove in my brain that I started to write others.
It cut a groove in my brain, too. Thank you.
Pardon?
It cut a groove in my brain, too. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Hi. One of my favorite things about your writing is that you're really mean about people. And I love that. It's hilarious. How do you feel about being perceived as like kind of cynical, and do you see yourself as kind of a cynic?
No, a cynic is someone who doesn't believe in anything. I might be a pessimist and I might be skeptical, but I don't believe I'm a cynic. Am I mean to actual people or just fictional characters? Yeah, that's what they're there for. I'm pretty hard. I make them do some unfortunate things, and unfortunate things happen to them. I also love a sad story, and someone's got to be in the sad story, and it's not going to be me. So it's going to be this fictional character, and they're going to have to go through this sad story. But I love sad stories. I actually don't have enough sad. You know, this is why I write fiction. I have to invent it. I mean, someone asked me the other night, well, why don't you write nonfiction? I say, I have no material. I have the 60 Minutes camera crew at my wedding, and that's it. I don't really, I got nothing, you know. So, but I have a lot of feelings and observations, and I've witnessed a lot of things, and I'm interested in a lot of things. And I don't feel cynical, but I do feel skeptical, and I like to put fictional characters in motion and then watch them suffer a little bit, because that's the kind of story I love. It's the human condition. It does seem to be the truest story, but a story that has no humor in it is also not true. So a sad story with humor, to me, is the truest thing that exists. And so that's why I may seem a little mean. But it's not intentional. Or it's intentional only in the way that I just said.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned your mother's tonight, because your short story, That's More Than I Can Say About Some People, I think is one of your most endearing stories.
Oh.
And it just, you know, maybe it was when I read it, I don't know, but I think it's interesting that you talked about your mother's. How did your mother feel when she read that story?
The Ireland story?
Yes.
You know, it's funny, because I was just talking about that story last night with another writer who is my age, and we're obviously... I mean, it's a mother-daughter story. And I didn't go to Ireland with my mother. I went with my husband. And we did, you know, and I took notes on this trip. But I thought, what if a young woman character, took her mother and all their failed love and their private grievances and unhappinesses, but took, you know, put them in the rental car and took them around Ireland, and what would you have at the end? And there is a way that maybe that character is like my mother. When I imagine that character, I don't see my mother, and when I see my mother, I don't see the character. I don't think she would have thought that character was her at all. She never said anything whatsoever about it. But mother-daughter things go really, really deep with... I mean, so much is in literature is about fathers and sons, don't you think? And mothers and daughters, it can cause you just to burst into tears thinking about all the ways mothers and daughters have failed each other in a way and yet love each other and see each other. And that's what I wanted in that story. But I think my mother was focused on a couple of other stories that had mothers in them, but not that one, because she knew she didn't go to Ireland with me, so she thought, well, that's not about me.
Okay, so I think that's a good place to end. Thank you, everybody,
for being here.
Thank you, Laurie, for writing such a great book.
Thank you, Jaden.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.